Greetings to the crew of the Gaia Navigation Experiment, to friends, students, and allies across the planet, and anyone else who cares to listen. Once again, this is your navigator, John Lash, recording on the 20th of February, 2013. The title of this talk, number 51 in the nav briefings, is Mephisto Rules. I just got news this morning that my book is out in Italy, that is to say, just off the presses. So as I speak, Not in His Image is being distributed to bookstores, over 300 bookstores in Italy. At the very same moment, news breaks regarding the circumstances surrounding the resignation of the Pope. It appears that in some way his resignation may be connected with the release of Holocaust files held in the Vatican Library. Whatever the reasons for Ratzinger stepping down, it's certain that there's a lot of dirty business behind the scenes, the dirty banking business of the Vatican, the dirty business of pedophilia in the Catholic Church, and on and on and on. We've all heard that song before. These people dance to the Mephisto waltz in their fucking sleep. But what I find interesting about this recent leak, which seems to be coming from Gordon Duff, interestingly enough, I keep having these brushes with veterans today, and I have a sense that my Dakini handlers are putting me into a loop that is connecting me at some point with veterans today. Anyway, there's a short post on Veterans Today, and there's a related YouTube clip stating something along these lines. Ratzinger was on the verge of giving public access to the vast amount of files in the Vatican Library, which have been held secret, regarding the actual records of the Holocaust. And the presumption is that were these files to be released and studied and analyzed, they would prove beyond doubt that the Jewish Holocaust narrative is a complete fable of fabrication and a lie. Although indeed there was a great loss of life of many different countries and many different ethnicities, if you will, during the Second World War. There was never, according to historical revisionists, a Holocaust of the Jewish people in the scope of the numbers described, 6 million, nor was there a Holocaust program of total extermination, nor was there gassing of millions of Jews in chambers, nor was there any of the atrocities generally described in the Jewish Holocaust narrative, typically routinely described. Although, of course, there were many atrocities committed on all sides during the Second World War. So apparently the release of these Holocaust files in the Vatican would bust the Jewish Holocaust narrative right down the middle. And I think you might recall that I said a while back that that was the key seam in the great lie that is dominating humanity, the great lie being used to perpetrate social orchestrations of social evil on this planet. I compared it to something like the Hoover Dam. And down the middle of this dam, down the middle of this vast concave wall of concrete, there is, as it were, a seam. And when the seam breaks, the whole dam breaks. The whole construction of lies breaks at the seam. And the seam is the Jewish Holocaust lie. I would point out, in case you don't know it, that merely to come out publicly, which I'm not doing, by the way, and merely question the standard Holocaust narrative, 6 million Jews, gas chambers, extermination plan, and so forth, is a crime punishable by severe measures in a number of countries around the world, and quite a few European countries, though not, I think, in Spain. You will recall the moment around August 22nd or August 23rd of 2012, when there was a single and unique perigee hit in the fulcrum of the scales. And at that time, I did not predict any event at that moment, and I did not predict any subsequent events, but I indicated you to be vigilant and to observe if there might be a trend, to observe a certain kind of trend in the social discourse on the planet, and a trend in the deeper channels of the collective unconsciousness and in the narrative. Everyone needs to know, in the GNE or not, that the battle for the future of humanity and the war against the enemies of humanity, the self-declared enemies, I might add, depends largely on winning the narrative. You win the narrative and much more than half the battle has been won. And I suggested regarding that August 22nd event that you might observe in the remaining period of correction a change of balance. You might observe that the game, which is rigged to the psychopaths and predators, rigged to their advantage, might get out of their hands. The game might change, and things might appear in the human mind and in the current of social events that would indicate that the decent and honest people in the world are gaining advantage against the charlatans, the predators, and psychopaths. So what that single hit in the scales, it's a singular and unique event in the whole 3 years of correction, signified was the moment after which such a change would become evident. I do believe this change is now becoming evident. And one of the places that I would direct your attention is toward historical revisionism, as it's called. Historical revisionism focuses largely on the story of the Holocaust. Historical revisionists are not Holocaust deniers. This is a slanderous syntax applied to them in order to persecute them. I am not a Holocaust denier. Historical revisionist is simply someone who claims the right, I won't say right because I don't like this word, someone who chooses to go and investigate the factual basis of a certain narrative that operates in historical and social discourse. And it's my perception, and I'm happy to announce this to all of you, that historical revisionism is beginning to get recognized and beginning to have credibility and beginning to have some skin. You know, there's a term, if you have skin in the game. It's an interesting term, isn't it? It's almost like a hunter's term in some sense. Anyway, historical revisionism is now starting to have skin in the game. And the game is the game of controlling the narrative, which has a lot to do with Mephisto rules, as we'll see. So this is a great breakthrough. Things are shifting in that direction, and I encourage all of you in the GNE to educate yourselves and to go and look into historical revisionism. Now, there are three key points of investigating historical revisionism. One, of course, is to go and look at the sober, sane, and well-documented work that has been done by courageous individuals independently and without any benefit to them and without any payment, and often at great risk of their lives and freedom, the work that has been done, simply to investigate if the Jewish Holocaust narrative could have happened in the way we are asked to believe, in the way that we are demanded to believe. And so that's one place to go investigate. Corollary to that, of course, is the Hitler/Nazi scenario. And I would advise you of one thing, if I may. Be very careful in your mind, and not to mention in your language, but using the word Nazi. Because if you use the word Nazi as an insult, if you say the Bushes were Nazis, so-and-so is acting like a Nazi, meaning a cruel, tyrannical, sadistic person, then you are, in fact, using the term, you are adopting the term Nazi as it has been contrived for use within the Jewish narrative, Jewish Holocaust narrative. If you say, the Argentinian government has become tyrannical and they're all acting like Nazis, don't say that. Because if you say that, you are actually using part of the standard Jewish Holocaust narrative, which is now falling apart. And you are, in fact, endorsing that narrative by adopting the definition of Nazi that derives from that narrative. Now, the second corollary point of investigation of the narrative is to look at Adolf Hitler. Listen to some revisionist lectures about Adolf Hitler. There's a very excellent, 14-part documentary, I think, on Hitler called The Greatest Story Never Told. Go look at this. Go look at this. And you might find that if you know the facts, for instance, of why Hitler invaded Poland or why Hitler invaded Russia. Do you know why Hitler invaded Russia? Do you know why? Actually, why? That is to say, the why that can be substantiated by historical analysis and also by the words and documents of the Nazi Party and of Hitler himself. You don't have to speculate about why. If you go and look at the record of history, it will tell you why. Now, consistent with the Jewish Holocaust narrative, you would be told that Hitler invaded Russia because he was a madman, he was a tyrant, he had a plan of world domination, by the way. Hitler's plan of world domination, as historical revisionists will tell you, was a lie planted in the collective consciousness of the world by, I think it was, President Woodrow Wilson, in a paper that he wrote that was undoubtedly written for him by one of his handlers, in which he made all these statements regarding Hitler's plan and Hitler's grand scheme of world domination, which were entirely and completely unfounded and untrue. And then that pack of lies became the program attributed to Adolf Hitler, which was not the program that Hitler himself was pursuing. Now, the reason why Hitler invaded Russia was because he was afraid and concerned, and deeply concerned, that the genocide unfolding in Russia following the Russian Revolution of 1917, a genocide that can be proven to be have been directed by Jewish Bolshevik ideologues, was going to spread to Germany. And in fact, there was a Bolshevik movement in Germany, in southern Germany, in Bavaria, led by Rosa Luxemburg and some other person, I forget his name. And so what Hitler saw, which turned him into the politician slash military leader that he became, was that he saw the danger of the genocidal, brutal and sadistic genocidal insanity of Jewish Bolshevism, communism, spreading to his beloved country. And he wanted to protect Germany from that happening, and he also wanted to protect all of Europe from that happening. And so this is a fact of historical revisionism. Go back and look at it. Now, I'm not saying that Hitler was a Boy Scout. He was the sweetest person in the world. But he certainly was nothing like he has been portrayed. And neither was Lee Harvey Oswald. And so that third point of historical revisionism for you to consider if you wish to educate yourself in this subject. And this is all relative to the Mephisto theme, by the way, because Mephisto uses lies. He's the prince of lies. And what is the form that lies take in our world? Well, lies take the form, one of the forms they take is the form of a distorted and deceitful historical narrative. The history of World War II, as you know it, as I know it, as I was taught, as the world today is still taught in high schools and universities, is a stinking pack of lies. And this is Mephisto rules. That is to say, operating by Mephisto rules. And one of the Mephisto rules is that you cannot arrogate. You cannot stand up and question the claim that Adolf Hitler was a sadistic madman bent on turning the world into a fascist nightmare. You cannot arrogate against that claim. That is a Mephisto rule. It's a rule. Think about this for a minute. Go back and look at Sandy Hook. I talked about the rules that apply to the display, public display of photography. In this case, still photographs of dead children, a still photograph of the damage in the school rooms, still photograph taken from a CC camera of the killer, the shooter entering the school, or even CC camera footage of 400 plus children being evacuated from the school. According to Mephisto rules, you can't see those photographs, can you? But the question is, who makes the Mephisto rules? And how are they enforced? For Americans such as myself, the key point, the key event in enter the liberating path of historical revisionism is, you know what? The Kennedy assassination. I was sitting in a history class in the afternoon around 3 o'clock at the University of Maine in Orono, Maine, when there was a knock on the door. That was the moment that the campus at the University of Maine learned that JFK had been shot. Everything we were told on that day and in the subsequent days and in the subsequent years is a stinking pack of lies. Lee Harvey Oswald, if the truth be told, would have to be recognized as one of the great American heroes, along with Patrick Henry and any other, Paul Revere, and any other great American hero you want to take from the period of the War of Independence. And America is now engaged in its real War of Independence. And maybe that's why my handlers are taking me around and around again in close encounters with veterans today. So all this is about Mephisto rules, all this is about historical revisionism, which you can regard as a strategic attempt, a strategic move against Mephisto rules in the historical narrative. And this may be breaking along with Vatican scandal at the same moment that not in his image appears in Italy. So what do you make of that? Here, just for what it's worth, is my 2-minute analysis of what is happening at the Vatican. A lot is happening, and none of us can actually know what all the spaghetti is about, you know, where all the strings of spaghetti lead or where they come from. But I figure it this way. J.P. Morgan Chase terminated its contract with the Vatican Bank sometime last year. And I believe that in the international banking mafia, which is, of course, run by Jewish mob bosses such as Bernanke and other people who don't even need to be named, in the international banking mafia, there are a lot of vendettas. You know, there were a lot of vendettas. There are a lot of murders that we don't even know about. And I think that the break between J.P. Morgan Chase and the Vatican Bank created a very nasty breach in the international banking scene. And I think that it is highly unlikely that the Vatican shithouse rats of the Vatican would give out any information about the Holocaust, that would give anything at all for the betterment of humanity, unless it favored them in some dirty and nasty murderous plot of infighting. That's the only reason why they would give anything out. And so if this is indeed the case, as suggested by the Gordon Duff interview or leak or whatever you want to call it, then I would say that the Vatican is taking revenge against the Jewish handlers, Jewish mob bosses in the international banking racket, by taking the lid off the Germans. And I can't say how happy I am to hear that, because I really love the heritage of Germany. And I love the pagan and heroic spirit of Germany as much as Hitler himself did. Yes, it's the Aryan spirit, but it's not a white supremacy game. It's a recognition by a race, namely the Teutonic race, of its own intellectual and moral excellence. It's not a white Nazi supremacy game. The race supremacy game is not a monopoly of the German Nazis. You all know where the race supremacy game originates, don't you? And you all know who runs it to this day, don't you? And so I can see a dirty, dirty fight between the Vatican shithouse rats in red capes and the Jewish bosses of the international financial mafia. And in order to take a really big swipe at those bosses, the Vatican are going to take the Germans out of the pressure cooker of guilt. And that would be fantastic. And one omen, one sign that events are moving in that direction is that not in his image would come out in German. So, this is exciting. I dare to say, I venture to say, that the balance is turning. As we put it in Kalika terms, we like to say everything we can by using a gaming metaphor. Remember that. It's part of your practice as a Kalika. You use the gaming metaphor. So I'd like to say that the odds are changing with this Vatican event, with the appearance of not in his image in Italy, with the breakdown of the Jewish Holocaust narrative, and all hell is breaking loose. And to revise an old Chinese proverb, may you live in interesting times. May you live in times when all hell breaks loose, because those are the times of Kali Yuga, when both spirituality and the arts of pleasure reach a screaming crescendo. Thank you. The lyrics say, "Pleased to meet you. Hope you guess my name. But what's puzzling you is the nature of my game." And that is the introduction to Mephisto, straight from the Rolling Stones, from the lyrics of Mick Jagger and Keith Richards, and what lyrics they are. You've got Jesus in there, you've got the Russian Revolution, you've got the death of the Kennedys, and who did it? It was you and me. It was you and me who killed the Kennedys, folks. We did it in complicity with Mephisto. And so, excuse me for the distortion on that recording, I just put the mic in front of my speakers here. We all know that song, all of us diehards from the 60s. And note how in that old rock and roll classic, there is in fact a kind of allusion to Goethe's Faust. "Pleased to meet you. Hope you guess my name." Well, why would you have to guess my name? If I meet you in a social situation, you see that I'm a man of wealth and fame, which I of course am, and I am elegant as Mephistopheles myself, but I don't tell you my name. You have to guess. Why? If you read Faust closely, you will see that Goethe observes a magical principle. And he does it in a most subtle and ironic way. All in all, Goethe's Faust is a masterpiece of subtlety and irony on a monumental scale. You know, one thing that the Romantics, the German and the English Romantics particularly, were known for during that time, the high point of the Romantic movement, 1820, signaled by a Uranus and Neptune conjunction in the Scorpion, or in the Archer, excuse me. What those Romantic visionaries were known for was irony, which is a Socratic virtue, by the way. Socrates invented irony. And this irony you find, for instance, in Byron's Don Juan. It drips irony. It's like juice that drips out of it as you mouth the verses. And likewise with Goethe's Faust, there is this irony, and part of irony is that you withhold what you know and what you could say in order to make what you could say even more powerful. So irony is not a technique of dissembling or manipulation, certainly not as Socrates practiced it, but it's a tease, and it's a way of revealing something that would be less powerfully revealed if it were stated openly. So, to get back to the point here, if you read Goethe's Faust, and I do hope you're reading it, try the Walter Kaufmann translation, which is in one volume. It has, I have it right here, it's a Doubleday anchor book. You'll find that Mephisto never identifies himself by name. He doesn't introduce himself by name. You have to guess his name. And this is so fantastic in the way that Goethe handles it. Let me explain that all through Faust, you don't find it stated actually that Mephisto is Mephisto. What you find stated, rather, is the lie of Mephisto, namely, that he is a broker or representative of the devil or Satan. But the truth is that there is no devil or Satan, and that Mephisto, the broker, who pretends to be offering you a deal with a third party, is actually dealing with you directly. That is the first move in the Mephisto mindfuck. And so there is also, and so Goethe plays ironically with this matter, with this trope. The name of Mephisto is not stated. Mephisto does not name himself. But Goethe, who also understood deeply the traditions of European magic, knows that if you have the name of an entity, you can control that entity. This is an ancient principle of magic. Now let's just take a moment here. Just stop and be very quiet and cautious and sober. And let's just look at this for a moment, this ancient principle of magic. The idea that the naming of something gives you power over what is named has a very deep origin in the history of the Anthropos. If you want to go back and look for the roots of it, you would go back to Fraser, the Golden Bough. You would go back into the anthropological studies of animism as it was defined by Tyler. Here I refer specifically to Sir Edward Tyler, a British anthropologist. In 1871, he published a book called Primitive Culture, in which he laid down what was to become the standard definition of animism. It had been defined previously by another anthropologist, George Ernst Stahl, around 1720, actually, very interesting moment in regard to the awakening of the Aeon Sophia into her lucid nightmare. 1720, very close to 1727, the beginning of the visions of Jigme Ligpa. In any case, this is not the roots of animism I'm talking about. They go all the way back to the Pleroma. No, I'm talking about the roots of the scientific and anthropological syntax by which we describe animism. And so animism was understood to be, according to Tyler, quote, the general doctrine of souls and other spiritual beings in general, or according to Stahl, a better definition, the doctrine that animal life is produced by an immaterial soul. I mean, this syntax is, as you can see, some has the elegance of peanut brittle stuck to the roof of your mouth when you wake up from a heavy vodka hangover. My definition of animism is not the belief or doctrine, but the perception that everything material is alive and animated. And so, on the platform of the experience of animism in our species, human animals who are particularly endowed with the power of language by the Aeon Sophia and Thelete, their joy is born in us through the gift of language that excels in the human animal. Through this power of language in our endowment, we came to understand that when you name something, you in a certain way possess it. You command power over it. Now just think of what I've said of late. I mean, what does this bring to mind? What is the highest desire of the Gaian Dakinis, including Vivi herself? It is that you command them. Now again, stop and let's look at this most wondrous realization taking shape before your eyes right now. The Dakinis of the Shakti cluster have names, don't they? How do you know who your guardian Dakini is? This, by the way, identifying your guardian is one of the practices of Gaian Tantric magic, of which I have not spoken yet adequately. But how would you, every one of you, who enters planetary tantra is assigned a specific guardian or handler from the Shakti cluster. How do you know who she is? Is it Tara, the wrathful green Tara? Is it Bhairavi? Is it Kamala or Kula Devi? Is it Kali herself as my guardian? Is it Matangi? How do you know? I'll tell you how you don't know. You don't know if you have a psychic experience or an intuition in which that entity tells you her name. Nope. That's not her. She will not tell you who she is. You tell her who it is. You tell her. You see, this is the power of magic. Even in the Gaian planetary magic of the Shakti cluster, this ancient principle of naming the power, naming the supernatural force, applies. One of the reasons that Faust is under the control of Mephisto is the same reason why the whole planet is under the control of Mephisto, is because they do not name the controller, the handler, the trickster. I cannot tell you how powerful it is to be able to name Mephisto. I consider that this doing so, having done so, that I demonstrated one of the paramount acts of my power. And you all have that power now. It's transmittable. There is a transmittable capacity in using the name Mephisto. Behind my act of naming Mephisto is transfer or passage of command. And so, I want you all to take a deep breath and realize what you have. The mantra that we take, the mantra that Kalika warriors take into the battle, the mantra that they sing as they stand in the battle formation behind Kali central, Matangi right flank, Kurukula left flank, that mantra is Mephisto rules. Mephisto rules. Mephisto rules. Of course, it's a double entendre, isn't it? You can take it as a declarative sentence. Mephisto rules. And this is a sentence of truth. This is a sentence of Matangi perception. If you have the Matangi eye, you look at the herd, the collective of the human animal, and you say, Mephisto rules. But the other side is, you see the Mephisto rules. And when you see the Mephisto rules in operation, aha, aha, and aha again, Mephisto rules no more. Because Mephisto depends upon you not seeing his rules, in the same way that a stage magician depends on the success of his trip that you not see his procedure, you not see the trick he uses to saw a woman in half, to produce a dove out of a handkerchief. The magic, the efficacy of Mephisto's magic depends, A, and primarily, on him not being named, and B, on you not seeing the rules that he gets you to follow. Now, I watched last night a film. It's written by David Mamet. It's a pretty good film. It's okay. It's a little-known film. It's called House of Games. And this film is about a confidence man, and it takes you into the life of a group of con artists, as some well-known films have done. For instance, The Sting, famous film with Paul Newman and Robert Redford, and The Grifters, which is a gruesome film with Angelica Houston. These films about confidence artists are great studies. And I watched The House of Games, and there's one line in the movie where Joe Mantegna, who plays the principal con man, is explaining to this woman. He says, this is why it's called a con game, a confidence game. It's called a confidence game not because I gain the confidence of the mark. I win the confidence of the mark and therefore dupe them by winning their confidence. No, it's called a confidence game because I give him my confidence. You see? And what this is what Mephisto does. He gives you his confidence. And that is his most subtle trick, because in doing so, you can't see how he dupes you into following his rules. The main strategy of Mephisto is to dupe you into following his rules, the Mephisto rules. Again, the analogy is perfect. The main task of a successful stage magician is to dupe you in following his movements, the hand gestures, the movements of his head and eyes that he uses while performing his trick. He gives you confidence by showing you what he does to misdirect you and distract you from what he actually does. And so our mantra is, Mephisto rules. And you can slap your thigh and snap your fingers in public as a gesture that you know that you are walking around in society that is operating, whose population is operating like zombies in a post-hypnotic trance under Mephisto rules. And I cannot tell you the power that I have put in your hands. I'm not going to brag about it, although I'd like to. You'll know what it is when you use it. Nobody else has the game breaker that you now have with me. The game breaker, the deal breaker even, is to say the name Mephisto and to know that there is a supernatural agency operating in the evil complicity that spreads across this planet. As I pointed out when I introduced the term, the name Mephisto, and lately I've been saying Metaphisto. Metaphisto and Mephisto. Metaphisto is an interesting name as well, because Metaphisto is like the metaphysical game that goes along with the financial con game, that goes along with the sexual con game, that goes along with the political con game. You know, there is a metaphysical con game, which is called the New Age, which is called Theosophy, which is called the unity of all religions, you know. So you could say, okay, there's a Metaphisto. That's the name he uses when he's playing the spiritual con game. But to get to the point, when you have the name Mephisto and you give the name to that agency, just as you give the name to your guardian, you name who she is. She doesn't come and tell you, I'm Kamala and I'm your guardian in the Shakti cluster. No. All of the channeling, all of it that you can read about, that has had so much influence in so-called New Age spirituality since the time of Blavatsky, is based on encounters in which the channeling agency introduces itself. I can guarantee you, you're going to love this, that any channeling agency, any disembodied psychic agency, any angel, any Grand Master from Atlantis, like Ramtha, any member of the Himalayan Brotherhood, like Jao Kul or Morya, any of these other entities that people are channeling who introduce themselves are demonstrating the trick of the trickster who does not introduce himself ever. And so they are nothing but errand runners for Mephisto. But when you are engaged with the Shakti cluster, you need to bring your discernment and your sensibility to name the frequency of energy that you are engaging with, the frequency of the sentient, intelligent, vital, erotic power of the earth. You name that frequency. It does not declare its name to you. Extremely important principle. And with that, which is what I'm getting to here in this roundabout manner of speaking, is what I would call the primary realization that can hold you in the knowledge of who Mephisto is, who is the trickster. The primary realization, let me repeat, that holds you in that knowledge is so important to define and redefine and redefine again. I take you back to events known to the whole world. The Sandy Hook events, 9/11, Kennedy assassination. Every intelligent and sober person who has investigated these events comes away with the same impression. There is a vast web of conspiracy surrounding these events. There is a vast web of conspiracy. Less so, the web of conspiracy gets denser and more complicated as we come forward from the Kennedy assassination. In fact, the Kennedy assassination has been solved, and a lot of the aspects of that conspiracy have been thoroughly elucidated to the point where they could be argued in a court of law with absolute conviction and absolute veracity. But we start at the Kennedy assassination, and we move ahead to 9/11. That's like light years into complicity beyond the Kennedy assassination. And then up to Sandy Hook. And you investigate these events, and you detect some of the actual threads of complicity. You know, who is complicit with who? In 9/11, for instance, the neocons were complicit with the Israeli security companies who are responsible for security at the airports and security at the World Trade Center. And they're complicit with the Jewish owners of the real estate in New York City. And so this is a complicity. The basic complicity in 9/11 that can be identified is a three-point complicity between the neocons in the Bush administration, the Jewish-Israeli connections in the security zone, and the banking and insurance companies who profited enormously from 9/11. That's the main complicity. That's all been proven. And then, of course, there's the complicity of the media. I'll get to the media at the end of this. Probably this is going to be Mephisto Rules 1, because quite a bit to lay out here. So, okay, a four-point complicity. The neocons, the Jewish-Israeli firms responsible for security, the banking and insurance and brokerage firms who made so much money, and then the media who released the narrative within hours of the event and repeated and reinforced this narrative endlessly and do so to this day. Okay, but that's all the identifiable complicity. when you examine 9/11 and then when you come ahead to Sandy Hook, what do you find? You find that once all the spaghetti strands of, to use an Italian analogy, of the definable complicity have been named, put names and faces on them, make connections, there's something that remains, isn't there? There's always something that remains, isn't there? There's always some irreducible factor. And I would call it an irreducible and irrational factor. No matter how much you investigate the complicity and the conspiracy, connected with such events, there always remains something that cannot be explained. It's never satisfactory. You could research 9/11 for the next 20 years with a team of people. You could produce 100 volumes of evidence showing how it was done and who was complicit, and you would still not be satisfied that you understand and see in your mind how such complicity and conspiracy could have been perpetrated. And why is that? Why can't you see to the absolute source of the web of conspiracy? You can't do it until you factor in the supernatural. There is indeed something supernatural. There is a trickster element in the human mind itself that enables this complicity. And I'm here to tell you that you haven't even begun to realize how powerful is the intel that I've put in your hands. With the Mephisto name and with the knowledge that Mephisto rules, but when you see Mephisto rules with a Matangi eye, Mephisto rules no more. With that knowledge and that name, you as a single individual human animal single-handedly can change the whole game for the entire human species. And I know of which I speak, because that's exactly what I'm doing. And I'm demonstrating it as I do it with you. Everyone else can run around and say anything they want about Sandy Hook. And that PSYOP is not over, by the way. We're in an interim period. They're preparing the second part of that PSYOP. It's a two-part delivery system of the Sandy Hook PSYOP. So hold on about that. I do have more to say. I'm getting back to that. Everything that I say regarding these matters and everything that I say and that you say among yourselves regarding Mephisto and the trickster function of the human mind that causes us to be accessory to evil without knowing how, all of that comes in Matangi instruction. I have to tell you that I'm in Matangi instruction almost constantly now. And I don't really know what to compare it to. I was talking to Kundry about this, and we had a laugh when I said that she sits on my face all the time. I don't mean Kundry, I mean Matangi. And although Kundry is a Matangi woman. And I said to Kundry, well, I've never experienced anything in my whole shamanic intertonic life like the brilliance of this Matangi instruction to undo the trickery of Mephisto. The only thing that I could come up with as we were talking about it was, it's like as if you're standing in front of a huge plate glass window. And coming from the other side of the window toward you is a momentous, focused blast of wind, like the wind, a spiraling turbine of wind coming at you, like out of a wind tunnel. And this wind hits the huge window of plate glass and shatters it into triangular shards, glittering, silver, transparent, triangular shards of glass propelled by this wind turbine right into your mind. And embedded in your mind are these shards of glass. And every one of these shards of glass is a Matangi insight that breaks the spell of Mephisto. I have never experienced brilliance of instruction comparable to what is coming now from Matangi. And I am certain that you know what I'm talking about. So be mindful of the power that has been placed in your hands with this single name, just the name. Name the trickster, and you can beat the trickster. Because with that name, you don't have to go crazy anymore, like a dog running around chasing its own tail, trying to get to the bottom of the irrational, irreducible factor that causes humanity to be complicit in its own destruction. The source of that syndrome, the source of our susceptibility to fall into agendas of destruction is Mephisto. But the source of those agendas is not Mephisto. The source of those agendas of destruction on this planet are the enemies of humanity, and they are human animals, just like you and I, although I have to say that they are so corrupt and so depraved that you may as well consider that they don't have a germ of humanity left in them, and they are basically a kind of human vermin. Now, I would not even insult vermin. I would not even insult maggots or scum. Vermin and maggots and scum belong to the divine order of nature on this planet, and I respect them all, and I require that they keep their boundaries, because this is one of Gaia's rules and one of the first things she said to me. She said basically two things to me in the beginning to make me comfortable, because I was like overwhelmed by the realization that I could converse with her directly. And she said, hey, just watch your boundaries and take your pleasure. Make yourself comfortable. This is the first instructions I ever received directly from Vivi herself. Watch your boundaries and make yourself comfortable. Take your pleasure. We can do this in this world because all the animals in her menagerie on this planet have their proper boundaries. But this human vermin do not know what boundaries are. And you remember what is said of Yaldabaoth in the Nag Hammadi Codices. He departed from the place that was his own because he could not hold his boundaries. So this human vermin invades everything, and it wants to invade and occupy everything, internally and externally. And this human vermin is the faction of human animals on this planet who are the enemies of humanity. And I'm not making this up. You can go ask them. They're the self-declared enemies of humanity. They are the ones pushing the agendas of evil. They're the ones pushing the banking scam. They are the ones pushing the trafficking in women, the trafficking in human organs. They are the ones pushing drugs to the great pharmaceutical corporations. They are the ones pushing lies in the media and corrupting and misdirecting the natural, erotic, beautiful and innocent erotic impulses of youth. The enemies of humanity are human, but they are a human vermin. And the enemies of humanity rely on the metaphysical phantom, the material archetype and metaphysical phantom known as Mephisto, to keep humanity in a spell so that they can achieve their agendas. This is the picture. This is the only picture you need. This is the picture. This is the strategic view of the enemy and of the enemy's psychic and magical tactics for all Kalika warriors, and it's the only thing you need to know to fight this war. You don't need to know about secret plans and Mars missions, and the Russians are disguising cream pies as meteors and exploding them in the sky, and you don't, forget it. Forget it. Blow it all off and concentrate on Mephisto. Because I tell you, he is breathing in your eyes. And he puts a mist on your eyes. But the fiery breath of Kali dispels that mist. And so Kali, along with Matangi on the right flank and Kurkula on the left flank, are in the avant-garde of this battle with Mephisto and the enemies of humanity. And that is the most inspiring picture that I have ever produced in my imagination in my entire life. And it's real. You know how real it is. You are the proof of how real it is. You are the demonstration of how real it is. This is the chance to really engage in the war that is forced upon us on this planet. I don't want this war, but we are in a war. We are in a psychological and physical war, not only for the safety of all human animals and all that lives, but for the sanity of our species. A war for the sanity of humanity. That is the Kalika War. So remember, you can snap your fingers to remind yourself when you're walking down the street, when you're going to the stationery store, or when you're having an encounter with a neighbor or a stranger, and you get that Matangi nudge. You get the glimmer from that triangular sliver of Matangi insight flickering in your mind. And at that moment, you have the Matangi eye. And you say, Mephisto rules. But when you see how Mephisto rules no more. So I leave it there. Let's call this part one, obviously, of Mephisto Rules. And I get to part two, the first moment that I have. It's a beautiful, cool, brilliant early spring day here in Andalusia. I wish you all well and safe passage.